The next case is 96-1487, Jeffrey Whitman versus Jacqueline Whitman. Wait till I call on you, please. I'm sure Mr. Hawkins wants to take notes on your oral argument. Okay. Mr. Malone.
Good morning. May it please the court. Richard Malone from the appellant, Jacqueline Whitman. I would ask that I get to reserve 3 minutes.
Watch your time there.
This case arises out of a dissolution proceeding that was initiated in the Hancock County Court of Common Pleas in December of 1993. On March 16, 1994, a decree of dissolution was entered in the matter. On August 15, 1994, the appellant filed a Rule 60B motion to vacate and seek relief from the decree of dissolution. After some procedural posturing, an evidentiary hearing was conducted on February 9, February 10, and concluded on April 27, 1995. On July 25, 1995, the trial court issued its written findings of fact, conclusions of law, and judgment entry, granting Civil Rule 60B relief and vacating the decree of dissolution. It's been a very difficult case involving emotional issues, involving children, assets, and the breakup of a long relationship. It's also had a difficult process coming to this court, as most cases that arrive in this court do. There is one issue that is before the court today. That is, should the marriage of the party opposing a Civil Rule 60B motion, when the remarriage occurs after the filing of a Civil Rule 60B motion, absolutely preclude the trial court from granting relief under Civil Rule 60B?
Don't we first have to go to the issue of whether or not a 60B motion is proper for these kinds of matters? I guess it's probably before you practice, but I would practice both before the civil rules and afterwards, and part drafted some of these, and 60B was designed, I think, and I'd like you to argue against this if you don't agree, to vacate what we would know as default judgments on cognomen notes. We used to be able to just go over and say to the judge, default judgment was granted and set it aside. If we didn't have any rule, it was always done. Then 60B came in to supplement that. Now we're using 60B to set aside dissolutions and remarry people that might be married to somebody else. Is that what it's designed for?
Your Honor, I think Civil Rule 60B is designed to reach quite a number of circumstances. The example that you give with respect to default judgment fall under what I would characterize as the excusable neglect provision, typically, anyways, under Civil Rule 60B, because someone neglected to respond to a motion or a complaint to obtain a judgment.
No, let me stop you there. You never had a chance. You just took your paper over on a cognomen note, found the lawyer in the hallway, had them confess judgment, and the judgment was on.
That's correct.
And that's what 60B was designed to do, to set those aside, because we had an informal procedure where we did it automatically.
Well, I believe that the court, in adopting Civil Rule 60B and identifying five different categories under which relief can be granted, fully intended to expand the scope of relief that was available in those circumstances.
Including setting aside dissolutions. That have
including
to be,
setting aside dissolutions.
They can only be predicated on a separation agreement approved by a court.
Provided that the party that comes in and demonstrates that there was, that he fits or she fits within one of the five categories.
But why shouldn't the category under 60B of mistake, it does say, of course, mistake, inadvertence, why shouldn't we apply that only in a situation where the mistake goes to the very validity of the order of the court? Here, it doesn't seem to me it does. They both, I mean, even your client says there was no fraud here, that she simply thought she had a 50% interest in a business entity, and found out afterwards, even though she did the books, as I understand it, that she didn't have that. There was a disagreement among them. Why should we use, to pick up on Justice Douglas's thought, why should we use 60B to set aside an agreement that is otherwise, they agreed, I mean, the parties agreed to, it's a dissolution, they agreed to it. Why should we use 60B to make such a radical change in the status of the parties, particularly when one of them is since married, remarried?
Your Honor, number one, we do not agree that the appellant conceded the issue that there was a fraud involved. The trial court never reached the issue of fraud because the trial court elected to base its ruling on the element of mistake, which was an element that he was more comfortable with the evidence on. We have never conceded the issue that there was not fraud. We would indicate the court would not hear suggesting that the trial court has made a determination of fraud. Nor, however, are we conceding, as the appellee has suggested, that the trial court found that there was no fraud. The trial court's ruling was silent on the issue of fraud, and that was because he never had to reach that issue in the first instance.
Well, usually, wouldn't it be true, usually if someone believes that someone has withheld information from them in a fraudulent way or misrepresented when they're signing a separation agreement, usually we see those alleged as fraud. I mean, if one party was consciously misled by the other, that's fraud. It seems to me here, the 60B motion didn't allege that, did it?
Our motion did allege fraud.
I didn't think it did.
It did allege fraud, but Judge Hunter, in making the decision in the case, determined that he was not going to reach that issue because he felt he did not have to reach the issue based upon his findings with respect to mistake.
And if it's your cause of action is fraud or mistake or something else, why wouldn't you just have, in effect, an adequate remedy by way of a common law action?
Because the adequate remedy by way of a common law action leaves over the vagaries of whether or not Mrs. Whitman was correct in her understanding with respect to her ownership of the stock.
But that would be produced by evidence at the hearing or depositions in the common law action, as opposed to, again, remarrying these people who have been married to somebody else.
Well, Your Honor, if we go back to the divorce proceedings or the domestic relations proceedings, the assets, whether they were 100% owned by Mr. Whitman or 50-50 owned by Mr. and Mrs. Whitman, were marital assets. If in the common law or in the general division action it was determined that in fact it was 100% Mr. Whitman, Mrs. Whitman has no remedy because the general division does not have the ability to take the position that they are marital assets and to divide them in accordance with the appropriate standards for division of marital assets.
Weren't both parties represented here at the time of the dissolution?
No, they were not. Mr. Whitman practiced as an attorney.
I know, and he had her sign the separation agreement.
And they signed the separation agreement. They were not represented at the dissolution. They each consulted counsel in the interim period when they signed the separation agreement and when they ultimately appeared in front of the referee.
And before the final hearing. Right, so they were both, but they were both represented in some capacity before the final hearing.
They consulted counsel, yes. No attorney appeared.
Wouldn't it have been counsel's job, even in dissolutions, and I know this is a catch-22 for lawyers, I went through it, isn't it counsel's job to take a deposition to find out what the other side has if you're going to be bound by a separation agreement?
Your Honor, prior to the dissolution?
Prior to the final hearing. Because at the final hearing, you could always get up and say, no, I don't agree, and it's over.
I understand that. Mrs. Whitman's counsel, who she had just consulted during the interim period, was not aware of the final hearing. Mrs. Whitman was approached by her husband, and she agreed to appear on the 90th day, the very last day that the matter could have been heard. The case would have been automatically dismissed at the end of that day had she not appeared. And for reasons that were unrelated to what we're here about today, Mrs. Whitman succumbed to the request and she appeared and did so without benefit of counsel. shortly after the hearing, the process of evaluating what it was that the assets were and attempting to resolve those occurred. The motion for 60B relief was filed 5 months later when those efforts failed. The Court of Appeals decision created an absolute bar based upon remarriage, which is inconsistent with this court's own decision in Vandrick, in which the Supreme Court of Ohio, in reviewing a trial court's decision to deny relief and an appellate court's decision affirming relief, stepped in and granted 60B relief in a case in which the husband had remarried after the decree of dissolution had been entered. That case is directly in conflict with the Court of Appeals decision in the case before the court this morning.
Yes, counsel, it seems that the stumbling block, we know 60B and we know how to deal with it in other cases. The only difficulty here arises because of this, it seems to be a presupposition that to attack the separation agreement and the financial matters in this underlying dissolution, one has to resolve the marriage. And the Court of Appeals seem to say that because dissolution agreements are not modifiable, the whole judgment has to be reversed. But this is an equitable action, isn't it? Divorce is a dissolution is an equity. Equitable action. If it is equitable, why can't the judgment for the financial aspects of this be separate from the determination as to the marriage?
Simply because the court has determined in the past that the dissolution statute defines or lumps the entire matter into a single ball, if you will. You either throw out the entire ball or you cut it, or you can't cut it in half.
Maybe that's what we should examine.
That may be true, Your Honor. But the dissolution proceeding as a background for Civil Rule 60B relief is not a new commodity before this court. This court has looked at cases in which they have been dissolution. Vandrick was a divorce proceeding in that particular case, but this court has determined that a dissolution proceeding is subject to Civil Rule 60B relief in the past, and that's the reason we pursued the relief that we requested. The question is whether or not a trial court's discretion should be limited by an inflexible rule of law that simply says, get remarried a minute after your dissolution is completed, and you become bulletproof to a challenge of that dissolution and anything that you might have perpetrated on your spouse during the course of that process, relegating them perhaps to the not as equal remedies that they may have in the general division of the court.
Well, then it wouldn't, if we were to adopt that as a rule of law, which we don't, I don't think we have to reverse in this case, but it's that the rule of law would only stand for the proposition that where there is a mistake of fact, there's no fraud. I mean, the findings of fact are that it's a mistake of fact between the two parties. So the rule of law wouldn't be quite as broad as you suggest, would it?
Well, I don't think that
if we can find it to the facts in this case.
Drew the distinction between fraud and mistake of fact. They refer strictly on the basis that there was a...
Well, we'll write the law. It's in this court now. It doesn't matter what the Court of Appeals said. We'll write the law as we think it should be. So we're not bound by the Court of Appeals. We take the facts in the case, which is a mistake of fact. The trial court said there's a mistake of fact between the parties. And if we write the rule of law on that a second marriage, whatever the effect is, that's a lot different than, I'm just want to make sure we don't have misunderstanding about what a rule of law would be or the implications of it would be here, because it's not nearly as broad as, I don't think, on this case as what you might see, as what you suggested.
Well, we're simply responding, I guess, to this court in the context of what the Court of Appeals has done and the precedent that they've right. created, and we're asking the court to look at that because we feel that it's an inappropriate standard. I see my time has expired. Unless the court has any other questions, I will reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Malone. Mr. Hawkins.
Good morning. My name is Jeff Hawkins, and I represent the appellee, Jeff J. Whitman, in this matter.
Mr. Hawkins, let me start you with a question. Paragraph 14 of the trial court's conclusion of law says, when a separation agreement omits assets that are substantial in relative amount and material to an informed deliberate agreement about an equitable division of the property, the statutory requirement has not been met and the decree is a fatal flaw. What's wrong with that as a proposition of law?
Your Honor, you're referring to the title companies, I assume.
I think that's what the trial judge must have been referring to. That was the issue.
Your Honor, it's quite appropriately our position that in the spousal support section of the original separation agreement, there was an employment contract that I should mention. The employment contract was admitted as a trial exhibit at the trial court level. The employment contract set forth both of these parties' interests in Whitman Title Company. It was a $300,000 contract over 5 years, $60,000 per year. That's a significant amount of money in anybody's book. It was indirectly mentioned in the separation agreement that the employment contract was entered as evidence at the trial court level. The signatory lines indicated Jeffrey J. Whitman as the employer and Jack W. S. Whitman as the employee.
Well, but I thought...
I do not agree that there was that the title companies were admitted from the separation agreement. It was our position that were not, they were mentioned by implication to the employment contract.
So that your argument to the trial court must have been that the ownership of the title company was subsumed or whatever by this reference to the employee contract. Is that
correct?
Essentially that they didn't really forget about the title company?
Absolutely not.
It was mentioned, and this is how they disposed of that issue. That,
as adults, that's exactly what happened in this case.
So trial court just made a mistake on its conclusion that there was no disposition of the title company, I guess.
In our opinion, yes, that's correct. Now, in my response to the appellant's proposition of law, I responded that absent fraud, a party's lawful remarriage...
Counsel, I'm just thinking about what you just said. What was the value of this unmentioned corporation at the time of the dissolution?
Well, it wasn't worth much more than $600,000, I can assure the court that, and as such, $300,000 was clearly, as I alleged in my brief, her buyout in the interest of the corporation. I mean, she wasn't left high and dry as far as the corporation was concerned.
But no testimony was offered as to the value at all?
At the 60B hearing?
No, at the original dissolution.
No. But again, I think the Chief Justice pointed out, this is not, Jackie S. Whitman is a highly intelligent lady. She kept the corporate books. She ran the family finances. Quite honestly, she knew more about these parties' finances than my clients did. I think trial exhibit F speaks volumes to that. That was the letter from her then counsel to me after we met at Bowling, Ohio, prior to the dissolution hearing, in which she wrote me a letter 6 pages long setting forth assets and their values. Now, her attorney didn't pick these assets and their values out of a hat. He testified at trial that they were submitted to him by her. And I take exception to the inference that she consulted with an attorney maybe for an hour or something like that. If the court looks at the evidence at trial and the exhibits that were entered into, she had three separate significant meetings with counsel up in Toledo prior to the dissolution hearing. Her attorney testified at trial that he explained to her for 2.5 hours for the first meeting exactly what her rights were in a divorce and domestic litigation. She walked into that dissolution room with her eyes wide open. She made an informed decision to go through with the dissolution. Let's also not forget that this separation agreement was not one-sided. She reaped significant assets as a result of this dissolution hearing. Now, that being said, I don't think there's any dispute here that she was taken advantage of. If there was any misconduct on the part of Mr. Whitman, there was none. the trial court could be of this. After 6 days of depositions, I might add, during the discovery process prior to trial, there was no evidence of fraud reported at the trial court level. My client did not engage in any misconduct. All my client did was remarry on reliance on a valid dissolution decree.
While all the 60B business was going on, was there a common law cause of action even filed?
Absolutely. I want to bring that to this court's attention. The Second District, which although this is a Third District Court of Appeals decision, the Second District was sitting by silence, the court obviously is aware. They quite appropriately put forth that she had other avenues to pursue. She had common law causes of action to file. This is a corporation dispute. She had a shareholder-driven action. She had a common law action for fraud seeking money damages.
Dissolution.
That's correct.
And dissolution of the corporation.
That's correct. And I think that's important that the Second District, in their opinion, did not close the door to Jacqueline Whitman. She has other avenues to pursue.
Did she pursue any of those? Has she? Has she pursued any of those?
No, sir. She has not.
So there's nothing pending other than this?
Not as far as the title companies are concerned. There's always something pending in so far as far as the domestic relations case is concerned. But I would hope this court would keep in mind when it writes this decision. This is a domestic matter. There's much more involved here than who owns this title company. There's children involved and things like that. And I don't want to make light of the situation, but there are a lot more to consider here. The appellate in his brief says that my client was a witness after the trial court granted his 60B motion. Well, he's not the kind of prosecutor in Hancock County. He's not the law director of the city of Finland. There was a time there, and there is no dispute here in this court, that my client at one time was married to two women at the same time. That had made for great press in the Toledo papers and the Finley papers and things like that. I think that is an unjust result to render a person married to two people at the same time when a litigant has adequate remedies in law to pursue when they feel they have ownership of a title company. Now,
do you think if we were inclined to affirm, do you think we need to say anything about the second marriage here?
Pardon me, I didn't hear something.
Do you think we need to use the second marriage as a reason to affirm in this case, or are there other reasons upon basis upon which we could affirm?
Well, I can certainly answer that. Yes. The status of the record at the trial court level, and I argued this in my brief to the Court of Appeals, was clearly against the manifest way to the evidence. I think the status of the trial court level, the record before the trial court, did not give that trial court sufficient evidence in which to grant the original 60B motion. I think that the trial court here, I raise a lot of side of errors in the Court of Appeals. I think the trial court error at the trial court level for several different reasons. It was against the manifest way of the evidence. There was simply insufficient evidence to corroborate Mrs. Whitman's assertion at the trial court level that she, quote unquote, thought she owned 50% of the title company. That was what the trial court based its ruling on. There was a lot more evidence presented in trial.
Well, what did she own?
My client owned 100% of the stock.
So how does she bring the shareholder derivative back?
Well, she testified at trial. She used to have stock certificates that she no longer had.
You're here advocating for other avenues, but I'm not sure I understand if your position is she doesn't own any.
That's all right. Obviously, that would be my defense in the trial.
Okay. Well, so how does she bring... You stood here and said she can bring a shareholder derivative action.
That's one possible action. She could bring a fraud action.
It's an impossible action.
I disagree. She can... I'm not...
Wait, you're saying she should engage in an idle act. She doesn't own any, so how does she have any right to engage in that kind of litigation?
Quite honestly, that's our position, Judge. She has that avenue to pursue, the shareholder derivative action, and common law action for money damages, for fraud. There's other avenues to pursue that are quite...
I mean, that you're saying here, we're saying her alternative is for her to head down a blind alley. That's not an alternative.
I don't think it may not be a blind alley.
And it It appears to me that the only reason that you are arguing that 60B should not apply in this case is because of the remarriage.
That seems that's what the second district has been filing.
What are the other reasons? When I read 60B, I don't see any limitation in what types of actions it can be raised in. What are your other reasons that 60B should not apply?
In this case? Well, I aren't for me to agree with Mr. Malone on too much stuff, but I tend to agree that a 60B under certain circumstances perhaps would be an appropriate revenue as a solution. So I'm not saying that it should close the door completely.
Okay, but then you are saying that the reason that it should not apply in this case is because of the remarriage.
Absolutely, because there was no fraud or misconduct proven at trial on behalf of my client. I envision, quite appropriately, something similar to what Mr. Malone said. I envision a party completely defrauding their spouse, okay? Going through the dissolution hearing, getting the thing signed, and like in Danbury, a week later, remarrying and saying, ha ha, I'm remarried, you can't touch me. I don't think that's a just result either. I think if there's fraud or misconduct, I don't have a problem rendering someone married to two people because they were not an innocent party to the dissolution process. That's exactly what my proposition of law is. I'm asking this court, based on the facts, the narrow facts contained in this case, that as long as there's no fraud, 60B is not the avenue to pursue.
Well, that's
to
make but that's implicit in the question. That's why people file a 60B, to show the fraud. There is a prerequisite showing under the GTE automatic standard that they must be able to show they have a meritorious claim or defense.
That's correct.
And that's done by an affidavit or something. Was that done here?
Good point. The first motion for 60B, which I filed a motion to dismiss on, was that there was no evidence, no evidentiary material submitted with the original 60B motion. It was simply a...
What happened after that? Was it amended?
They filed an amended motion before the court ruled on the motion to dismiss.
And that included, I take it, an affidavit of the spouse setting forth that she had a meritorious claim against the court.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So for you to say that 60B doesn't apply here because at the trial we just didn't see that fraud, we didn't match. That begs the question. That's what the 60B hearing is about, right?
Well, that may very well be, again, at trial, in this case, there was no fraud and conduct proven. I think I want to draw one very simple distinction to answer your first question. In the original 60B motion, there was no mention of the title companies. She did not mention the original 60B motion.
But she amended. I take it that this is a timely amendment, so we should deal with that, shouldn't we, counsel?
Well, I disagree with that. The Court of Appeals, they filed their original motion for 60B. I filed a motion to dismiss. Before the court ruled on that motion, and without leave of court, they filed an amended motion with an affidavit. And the court then overruled my motion to dismiss and proceeded with the discovery process and went to trial.
Counsel, with respect to the underlying corporation, it seems to be about, is it your position that failure to mention it other than the employment contract is something that the parties worked out, that this treatment was an effort to get the most favorable income tax treatment for your client?
I'm not a tax attorney, so I'm not quite sure how to answer that. I don't know how to answer that question.
Well, if you don't know.
I don't know. But I don't do taxes. I do my own taxes.
So apparently it was not a motivation.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, it was an informed decision on both of these people's parts to set forth everybody's interest in the kind of numbers.
You weren't involved in this discussion.
I got a phone call. I'm quite sure. Very soon after Mr. Whitman was contacted by Jack Durbin's attorney on the day of the first collision disillusion hearing, he contacted me when he was I've not prepared the documents, I didn't know anything about it until the argument filed. Very quickly, because I see my time is almost up, the appellant relies on Vander versus Daniels. Two things I'd like to say about that case. Number one, it's a relic of the law. entertain reading if you read the case, but it's 1966 law before the civil procedure rules came in, before the new dissolution law. So, well, it should not be relied on by this point by any stretch of the imagination. Also, if you read the case clearly, and the way I read that case is that it does, stand for the proposition that my client shouldn't get any of the marital inheritance of the best. Vanderitt, quite honestly, stands for the proposition that the sanctity of marriage should be upheld. That is what that case is all about. I think this court should write a rule of law that stands for the strong public policy position that a lawful marriage should be upheld, especially in a case where there's no fraud or misconduct involved in the procurement of the separation agreement, in the procurement of the dissolution. There was no fraud in this case. I see my time is up. If there's no further questions.
So if there was fraud, you'd have us accept your proposition of law number one and say the remarriage was invalid. So you still have exactly the same situation. Let's assume that he knew that she owned some of that stock and he didn't disclose it.
Let me answer this. After 6 days of depositions, after 6 days of my client undergoing the deposition, I'm sure I would have figured out that my client engaged in fraudulent conduct. Okay?
I said assume it. I'm not assuming it. Assume it for purposes of this. Because your proposition says, absent the showing of fraud, a party's lawful remarriage would be a complete defense. Ergo, if there is fraud, the marriage is not a defense.
Yes.
You mean that?
I do mean that. There's no misconduct on the part of the party during the dissolution decree.
Then what was all the argument you had about the common law causes of action that they could raise separately?
The Second District did not close the door in this case.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hawkins. Mr. Malone, you've saved a little over a minute of your time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Number one, Vanderitt does not stand for the proposition that remarriage, it contemplates that remarriage may be a defense in these proceedings, subject to the sound discretion of the trial court who has a benefit of the evidence. The issue of spousal support that was referenced in the employment agreement. A review of the employment agreement discloses that, and a review of the separation agreement in conjunction with it discloses that the employment agreement was an explicit asset or agreement given in lieu of spousal support. It has nothing to do with the distribution of assets. There was a separate provision in the separation agreement that dealt with assets, which in no way identified the title companies or the ownership of the title companies. Mr. Whitman's suggestion, or the suggestion...
Counsel, it wouldn't be entirely unusual to counterbalance a sizable asset with an employment contract because that seemed to be a favorable tax result.
Your Honor, there was evidence at the evidentiary hearing that there was over $700,000 cash deposits in the title companies at the time of the dissolution. So the suggestion of a $300,000 employment agreement replacing spousal support where a woman who had been employed at the title companies making $100,000 a year prior to the dissolution is in some form the consideration for her interest in those title companies simply doesn't stand up. She was entitled both to the spousal support and to a division of the assets. Their suggestion that the employment agreement constitutes both isn't consistent with rational thought, nor is it consistent with the terms of the separation agreement. Separation agreement specifically says under the provision spousal support that the parties have entered into an employment agreement and therefore no spousal support is to be provided. The employment agreement was between Mr. Whitman individually as a lawyer in his law practice and on behalf of Whitman Title and Security, one of the two title companies. That's why he signed as the employer. That's why she signed as the employee, has nothing to do with the division of assets in the case.
Mr. Malone, let me ask you a question I don't usually ask, and it doesn't have a bearing on our decision, certainly, but this case seems to cry out for the question, have these parties attempted to settle this? issue?
There are a multiple.
And if you can't tell me, don't tell me, but it just seems like, talking about one asset, and somebody's been remarried and bigamy, and I mean, have they attempted to settle it?
There are issues which are non-monetary that continue to play this particular matter.
Communication is a problem, I take it, over.
And that is overcome any financial discussion or precluded.
Okay. Thank you. Case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.